Hi, I'm Dan. I'm eating a Hot Pocket outside in River North, and you're listening to Outside the Loop Radio, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you, Dan. Get that nutrition in River North. Good morning. Welcome to Outside the Loop. I am Mike Steven. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. This is show number 761. And maybe you are eating a Hot Pocket right now. I think they make the breakfast ones. I think so. It's been a while since I've had a Hot Pocket. What we do here on the show is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Say hello on Facebook, on Twitter, at Outside the Loop is the handle, on Instagram as well, and download the podcast of this show for free. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts. Also, check out OutsideTheLoopRadio.com or WGNRadio.com for the audio archives. Bob Ferguson is our wonderful engineer in the studio today, and Colin Seaman is the producer of the show. Good morning, Colin.
Mike, it is May. You are so close to the finish line. You are holding together every day. It is so good to hear you, and I wish you nothing but a speedy May, my friend. A speedy May.
You are referring to the end of the school year, as I am a high school teacher. And yes, the end of May marks the end of the school year. It's been a year. You know,
it has. And I know that this is your marathon May, your march to the finish May, your I want my mommy May, and you are holding it down. And I just want to thank you and all the educators out there for everything you did this year. We're almost there.
Well, thank you, Colin. That does mean a lot. And big shout out to all of the educators in the area here and just all over who have done a remarkable job under just less than remarkable conditions. Let's just say it's been a struggle, but we're going to make it, Colin. We're going to make it.
I'm glad to hear that. And I'm glad to be on the show today and have great stuff for all of our listeners. What are we doing today?
We have a lot of great things that we will be talking about. There is this whole notion of the increase in carjackings, and I shouldn't say it's a notion. I mean, it is happening. But the story around that is maybe not as complete as it should be. So we'll investigate that. Also, we'll talk about how the pandemic has impacted working moms in Illinois. And Kia Tramell, the great Kia Tramell. She's an amazing vocalist. She will be back here on the show. She has a new single out. And so we'll check in with Kia to see what is going on in her world. Hopefully, she's getting back out and performing live in the not too distant future. You know, Colin, speaking of, look, I'm almost at the end of the school year and, you know, it's a tough job, but it's sometimes a tough job when you work in the public sector. And those folks in the mayor's office found that out this week. So I don't know if you've seen this, you probably have, but there was that hack. Someone hacked the email system of the mayor. And there were a bunch of emails that were released, and there were some headlines this week about the issue of the mayor was, you know, allegedly easing ticketing, parking ticket restrictions, and then folks got ticketed anyway, and then she felt that there was bad reporting going on there. What is amazing to me is just to look at some of these emails, and you sometimes forget that those elected officials, right, who are high up, they use email like all of us. And the mayor's email here, first of all, she has her own at cityofchicago.org email, MLL, Mayor Lori Lightfoot, at cityofchicago.org, which I think was probably out there anyway. But the fact that they're just going back and forth about the response to this story, and they're very candid with each other, maybe forgetting that this could be FOIA'd or, heaven forbid, they're hacked. It's just funny to see that these powerful people, they use email, you know, please CC so-and-so, just like all of us do.
I mean, a story like this makes you think, you know, what have I written in email form?
Right.
I mean, there's hacks everywhere, right? Like the Eastern Seaboard and the pipeline got hacked. It's just hacks are a regular thing, right? So
yeah.
You just got to think, how are whatever the materials you have going to be presented in different lights. And then you think like, oh, I've got to send coded emails to my friends because it could show up on the internet in a different way these days.
Oh, man. Yeah, I know. I think if people were to look in ours, it'd be a lot of inside jokes and, hey, what are we doing on the show this week? There'd be a lot of that.
It would basically, I mean, truth be told, it'd just be a lot of, Mike, I'm not Andy. Please stop asking for Andy. Andy's not here anymore.
On that note, hey, this is Outside the Loop, and we are excited to bring you a quality program today. Full transparency, full emails out there. In Chicago, carjackings have spiked. Last year, Chicago had more than 1,400 carjackings, the highest in two decades, according to the Chicago Reader. The story from the Chicago Police Department is that the carjackings are caused by predominantly black youth who are out for joyrides. Dr. Robert Vargas is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Chicago. He says that there is little evidence to support that argument from the CPD, and he is here with us on Outside the Loop today. Dr. Vargas, welcome to the show.
Great, thanks for having me.
You're quite welcome. So, if you could here, just at the start of this conversation, explain in more detail, if you can, what that narrative from the Chicago Police Department is on this carjacking issue.
Yeah, so the narrative has been that carjacking is something that has been occurring in different parts of the city. It's certainly on the rise, and that it's that the offenders have predominantly been juveniles and folks of color. That's essentially the narrative, as you had said it before.
Yeah. You're saying, though, that this isn't the whole story. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so the police department is making their case off of a tiny fraction of information on carjacking offenders. So specifically, 15% of the carjackings, according to the police's own figures, have resulted in an arrest. And if we assume that everyone that has been arrested is guilty, that means that we only know about 15% of the individuals who have engaged in carjacking, which is a tiny sliver of the entire group of carjackers. And so that's kind of like, you know, trying to understand COVID-19 and basing your conclusions off of 15% of people who ever contracted COVID-19. Basic research standpoint, it's just very unwise to make very strong conclusions off of such a tiny sample of a group.
And so there's that issue that you do talk about. And there's also the issue of where these carjackings are happening, where they're most concentrated. We're really seeing this according to the Chicago police data. These carjackings are happening in pockets of Chicago's south and west sides, and not statistically in more affluent areas. This kind of contradicts this narrative from the police department that these carjackings are on the rise across the city of Chicago.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, in fairness to the police department, the initial reporting, particularly from the Tribune, was most responsible for the inaccurate description of where the carjackings were taking place, because the Chicago Tribune produced a map that simply mapped the total number of incidents and their location, which is misleading because you're not accounting for population, right? Areas that have higher concentrations of population are going to have higher carjacking rates. So what my lab did was very simply adjust for population. And when you adjust for population, you show that the carjackings are most concentrated on the south and west sides. And the Chicago Police Department was upfront about that from the beginning, to my knowledge. Like when the reporting of this came out, The police department wasn't being specific about the areas, but eventually they did come around to that. Mm-hmm. So all of that is to say that to a certain degree, it is the police department, but also to a certain degree, it's either local journalists' misunderstanding and misuse of geographic data analysis, or it's just straight sensationalistic media coverage that's trying to capitalize on people's fears.
So there's an element here, as you're saying, that media are playing in this whole story, that they've picked up on maybe parts of the narrative and have amplified it to an extent. That seems like it's pretty dangerous.
Yeah. And, you know, I have a ton of empathy for journalists because they have a hard enough job as it is. But when I think it comes to questions of like social science literacy or statistical literacy, journalists aren't social scientists, right? And so I'd like to give them the benefit of the doubt to think that they actually aren't trained in the methodologies to be able to fact check and correct when the Chicago Police Department is misusing their data. But at the same time, though, you know, this is the Windy City, and you know, and you know, every journalistic outlet has its political slants and its perspectives. And I think certainly at the same time, while there are many journalists that are not as scientifically literate, there are probably also some journalists that are playing to the fear narrative. But I think both the police department and the mayor's office, judging by some of the emails that have been released over the weekend, that, you know, they're trying to govern and justify and legitimize the need for the police, in part by drawing greater media attention to issues like carjacking to show that, okay, this is the reasons why we can't defund the police. And that's dangerous on a number of levels. One is that it leads to, you know, pushes for increased punishment, which we know don't work and which we know inflate city and state budgets. And so these days, even if you wanted to expand punishment, it's unclear that the city or the state has the funding to do it, right? The Fair Tax Amendment wasn't passed, and so there's no actual way for the state to increase revenue to persecute and incarcerate more people. So that's a non-starter. And you know, I think second is that it really does a disservice to the reality of the economic aspects of the carjacking increase, which is that, you know, there's a whole other alternative explanation for what's going on, which is that the carjackings are being driven by economic deprivation, and that there's a whole informal economy built around the selling of car parts, built around the selling of stolen cars through technologies that make it easy to like wipe a car's identity and sell it out of state. And so that to me is the biggest danger, is that it's taking a problem that's caused by economic insecurity and framing it in a way that's just trying to justify the status quo of trying to address every societal problem primarily through law enforcement.
You've written about this. I know recently you've said that in Chicago history, we have kind of a trend when it comes to this, what you call the politics of fear, that we have a history of using selective evidence to create or fit a narrative. And in this case, it's maybe, hey, we need more law enforcement. We need more, you know, in terms of looking at this crime issue, we've got to be tougher on it. So we've done this before in our history.
Yeah. You know, it was a very simple study that a group of students and I set out to do, to simply ask without any preconceived ideas or even hypotheses, just to look into the news media archives and policy archives, just to see what has the city done in the four largest homicide waves in its history. So there was one in the 20s, one in the 60s, one in the 80s, and then one in 2016. And, you know, we were very troubled by how similar the response was by the city at each time. because we have data on the locations of the homicides during each wave, even going back to 1920. And we were able to map the locations in the neighborhoods where homicide were most concentrated. And what was, and so the data told a story of homicide being concentrated in specific neighborhoods. But the archives revealed that at each time period, with the exception of 2016, when the police, when a lot of it was concentrated in Inglewood, but for the most part, across all of the time periods, the policies and the measures that the city took to address the problem did not map onto what the data were showing in terms of where homicide was most concentrated, where support was most needed. And in fact, what happened, I mean, even in some cases initially, like in the 20s and the 60s, the city denied that there was even a homicide problem. And in the 1960s, it wasn't until the civil rights demonstrations of Martin Luther King that Mayor Richard J. Daley began to see an opportunity to blame the uptick in violence and homicide on the unrest and the lack of law and order created by civil rights demonstrators. And remarkably, we saw that narrative resurrected by Mayor Rahm Emanuel and his police superintendent, Eddie Johnson, who discussed in 2016 the role of, quote, emboldened criminals, attributing emboldened criminals for the increase in homicide and increase in violence. And so it's a remarkably consistent and troubling pattern throughout history that I think can only be disrupted by more social scientists and more journalists speaking out and trying to really advocate for people in power and those in philanthropy to take a different direction.
This is a big topic and one that is rooted in our history, our society here in Chicago. And I know that Dr. Vargas, you and your associates and your students will continue to look at this issue. Dr. Robert Vargas is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Chicago. Dr. Vargas, really enjoyed this conversation. Hope we can do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Care burdens associated with the COVID-19 pandemic have deepened patterns of economic inequality for women in the workforce, and particularly for working mothers of color. That's according to a new report out by the Project for Middle Class Renewal at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana and the Illinois Economic Policy Institute. One of the authors of the report is Frank Manzo. He is the policy director at the Illinois Economic Policy Institute. You can check them out online, illinoisepi.org. Frank, welcome to Outside the Loop. Nice to talk to you, man.
Thank you for having me, Mike. Happy to be here.
Well, let's talk about this report. It is called Women and Child Care in Illinois, a survey of working mothers during the COVID-19 pandemic. And it's pretty in-depth, and it's available online. And so, talking about this report, you know, we know the pandemic impacted people in different ways. Specifically, what does this look like, this impact for working mothers in Illinois?
So it's a great question, and what we have found in our study is that 83% of working mothers, the vast majority, experienced school or child care facility closures in 2020, right? So the vast majority, their kids could not go to learn or play and socialize in person for at least some portion of 2020. And what that meant is that women, in particular, either lost their jobs or worked fewer hours in order to stay home and care for those kids. And working women already faced labor force participation and pay gaps relative to men even before the pandemic. So the pandemic has only worsened those disparities and exposed the urgent need for affordable child care, paid family leave, and other policy interventions to combat these problems in our economy.
So women have been staying home at a greater rate than men have, it sounds like, from this report. And, you know, you mentioned there was already a gender wage gap before the pandemic. And now I would think, like you said, I mean, this obviously would make that gap, I would guess, even bigger. I mean, do we have any data on that? Do we know how that has affected the gender wage gap?
So the data is still coming in on the effect on, you know, the percent kind of impact on the gap. But what I can tell you is that these pandemic-related child care demands caused economic hardships for mothers in particular. And so about half of all employed mothers, mothers who were working as of March 2020, right before, you know, the stay-at-home orders, about half reported that during the pandemic they worked fewer hours. And what that means is that they earned less income. We also asked, did you earn less income? About half said yes. Those two things are directly linked. And so, yes, the impact is significantly negative, and these negative consequences were most severe for working women whose children, schools and childcare facilities had closed, and for working women of color. And I should note that we asked, how did you compensate for these losses in income? And these working women primarily did so by delaying rent and mortgage payments, spending less on food, pulling from savings and retirement accounts, and delaying medical treatments. And these things have longer-term impacts on those women as well.
You know, I'm thinking about this in terms of our society, and maybe this is getting into the sociological realm here, but really, I mean, you're talking about this impact here on women, and it sounds like it is disproportionately, this pandemic has impacted women when it comes to economics and hours of work lost. And maybe that says something about our society, right? And how we look at women, because women have been, according to this study, you're saying staying home to take care of children, but we don't see the same thing happening with men, do we?
Yeah, so it's a great point, Mike, and it's that, you know, so yes, it's not only our study that's showing this. There's other research and data that's increasingly showing that COVID-19 has had a disproportionate economic impact, and that's important, their economic impact on women. You know, other data has shown that the labor force participation rate among women has dropped to its lowest level in more than three decades. So, you know, three decades of kind of progress, closing the participation gap and women entering the workforce, all gone due to the pandemic because women were more likely to stay home. And, you know, at the same time, we did, again, have those kind of school and childcare facility closures that placed other additional demands on mothers to help with remote learning and things like that. So, you know, of course, we felt this study was important to increase the public's understanding of the structural causes of you know, these disparities in the short term, but also kind of the long run implications of this pandemic on working mothers in particular.
So the next question here is, what can we do to address this? You've established in your study that there is this disparity because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And as you mentioned, other studies have proven this as well. What can we do policy wise going forward here to correct this?
So it's a great question, again, and I have two in particular. We have a couple policy options that lawmakers and quite honestly just businesses could consider offering to attract employees as well. The two I would really highlight are expanding affordable childcare and expanding access to paid leave, because both of these policies, both of these programs enabled women to remain attached to the workforce and not suffer significant income losses, and that's what we found in our study. In particular, you know, because not all of these women we surveyed had high child care costs or even had child care costs at all, right? Maybe they went to a grandma or something like that. And for the women who didn't have child care costs, they were more likely to say that they did not suffer an income loss. So if you did have child care costs, you were more likely to suffer a loss of income, and that's primarily because you worked fewer hours when, you know, schools and other facilities were closed. And then secondly, access to paid leave kept 10% more women employed and reduced their chances of suffering an income loss. So we see that these policies had an effect in keeping women attached to the labor force, keeping them employed, but at the same time, allowing them flexibility to take care of their children and their families in the time of need. And so these types of policies are important even beyond the pandemic going forward.
Yeah, I think this might sort of reignite a conversation about that disparity when it comes to gender and the workplace and pay. And like we've been talking about, this existed before the pandemic, but this pandemic, as in other areas of our society, has really just put a spotlight on some of the inequalities that exist. And I think if we have to take something like a silver lining from this pandemic, maybe we can sort of reignite this conversation about the importance of these interventions that can make things better for certain groups of people.
You are absolutely correct. I think the one of the lessons that could arise from the pandemic is that, as we defeat and rebuild from the pandemic, that we should invest in resiliency. How can we be resilient to the next public health emergency or natural disaster? And how can we promote policies that support working families and do that? And the other thing I would say that is important too, and it's something that the pandemic revealed because we didn't have kind of this type of case study before, but it is clear that schools and childcare facilities matter, because the closure of schools and childcare centers was directly linked with women reporting that they had a decrease in their job performance and that they suffered income losses. So it didn't result in them losing jobs, right? The pandemic was responsible for that. But if a school closed, it resulted in them staying home more often to take care of their children. And so what that means is that the opposite is true during, quote unquote, normal times, that schools and child care facilities kind of function as daycare services for working mothers and allow them to enter the workforce and be productive at work instead of staying at home. And so that's an important finding, I think, from our report as well.
The report is called Women and Child Care in Illinois, a survey of working mothers during the COVID-19 pandemic. It was recently released by the Project for Middle Class Renewal at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, and the Illinois Economic Policy Institute. Frank Manzo is the policy director at the Illinois Economic Policy Institute. Frank, thank you so much for this really important work that you and your colleagues have done, and thanks for talking to us today.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with me and shedding some additional light on this important crisis facing working mothers and working families across Illinois.
Hopefully, live music is back on the horizon for us in the not too distant future. In the meantime, though, we have some new recorded music to keep us company. Kia Trammell is a local musician, and she has some new music out right now. And you can check out KiaTrammell.com. That's KiaTrammell, KiaTrammell.com. And she is here with us once again on Outside the Loop. Kia, nice to talk to you again. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Thanks for having me.
You bet. I mean, the last time you were on this program was October of 2017. The world was a slightly different place back then.
Completely different, right?
And you played live here in the studio and you crushed it and you were sounding so good.
Thank you.
I'm next to blow, blow up like the sun, and I won't stop myself from going to the place that I want, because this God is in me.
You have new music out. We'll talk about that in a moment here, but let's talk about you as an artist coming through a very difficult year for everybody, but boy, especially for performers who thrive on energy of the crowd and the creativity, collaboration with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And now we can't be with other people, or we couldn't for so long. How have you been surviving the pandemic?
Oh, man. When it first started, I was in complete shock because I had gotten casted as Tina Turner for a musical production. And I was working so hard day in, day out at the theater, getting my arms toned, getting those Tina arms together and together, learning choreography and lines, which was something completely just new for me. And I was surprised that I'd even gotten, this lead role. And so going into the pandemic, I was kind of trying to detach myself from being Tina Turner for a while, actually. because you get so connected to the character. And then I want to say about maybe 3 weeks in, I'm like itching. I was itching for a performance. And all of my friends and like, you know, fellow musicians, they're going live. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to do a live. I want to be around people. I want to look in their faces. I want to probably jump off of a stage, which I have done before and really hurt my ankle. but I want to say maybe like at the end of May, around this time last year, I actually did kind of like a live. But that was the only live I actually did in May.
That's crazy because, I mean, I've talked to other musicians who have said, you know what? I was just going on Instagram Live, or I was just doing some sort of live stream with other musicians, and that kind of got me through. But it's interesting to hear your perspective that you just wanted to be so badly with people in person that you thought that the whole live streaming thing just wouldn't work out for you.
You know what? That the one time that I did it, it was actually amazing, and a lot of people chimed in. But for me, like you said, I need that. Oh, I desire that energy, and I didn't want to give so much of my energy. And also just from a business perspective, it's like, how many people actually want to see me live every day? You know, I feel like this might get tiring. You know what I mean? And I don't want to get bored with myself, and I don't want people to get bored with me as well. So my parents, because I went in quarantine with my parents, they got enough of me performing in the house.
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, it's great because you're so talented. That'd be great. Boy, like you wake up and like he is like singing you a song. That'd be amazing. But then maybe after day, like, I don't know, 140, it might grind on you a little bit.
Yeah, after that I was like, you know what, I'm gonna go and just take a walk and just do with my headphones and, you know, just do that, which was great because I was still getting exercise. I refused to get quarantine 15. I just couldn't do it.
So let's talk about the single that you've released recently called Double Rainbow. Tell us about this tune.
So Double Rainbow was actually written from an experience a few years back. I was with a loved one. We were in the car. It was a rainy day. We were trying to get to where we needed to get to. We ended up being lost. And somehow this double rainbow appears over the car. And it's like, oh, my God, it's a double rainbow. And I think anytime I've experienced a rainbow, it's kind of this bliss that I experience. And it gives you kind of like a hope, you know. And throughout the pandemic, me working on Double Rainbow, it was just like, OK, I need some type of energy, some type of hope, because I really am tired of being home. I really, you know, just desire to be happy and doing whatever I want to do, traveling or being with my friends. And now I'm like, OK, it's rainy season. This is a perfect time to release Double Rainbow and people can see themselves with it. So it's been interesting to actually release something that I've been holding for so long, because I wanted to release it when the world was kind of opening up again. People can, you know, dance a little bit with their friends, maybe with the mask on, especially if you have a vaccination. I am pro vaccination.
Yes. Yes. Love it.
So yeah, it's really a song about an experience in a car watching a double rainbow and, you know, feeling joyous about it and not wanting that moment to end.
Double rainbow. Double rainbow. Double rainbow. I love the principle and that is double rainbow. Remember when.
So you also have a music video that corresponds with the single, which is, it looks great, by the way. It looks
thank
awesome.
You. Thank you.
What's on the horizon here? I mean, yes, things are starting to open up, but are you thinking about more theater? Are you thinking about performing live again?
Absolutely. And for me, I think I would love to do like tour, maybe even overseas tour too. And I think with me having so much time, theater kind of stressed me out a little bit. I'm not going to lie to you. Just because you're like, okay, line. Let me look at my paper before I go on stage. Because before the Tina Turner musical, I had done Lady Sings the Blues, a story about Billie Holiday. And I actually gotten casted as Mrs. Flo, who had given Billie Holiday her first job as a prostitute. So even that role was intense for me. So it's just like, oh, make sure I have my lines, make sure I'm still in the character, make sure I can still sing and do these dance moves. So it was quite stressful for me. And the most natural thing for me is to perform live. So I would love to tour, you know, in America, do a few festivals like Lollapalooza. That would be great. Or even I was thinking like even the Pride Parade. It would be cool to even perform. Rainbow at the Pride Parade. That would be so much fun. And then hopefully, you know, go overseas and see what that's about.
Well, everyone should go to KiaTrammell.com. That's Trammell with two M's, two L's. That's KiaTrammell.com. And all of your social media contact info is on that site, and music and everything you need to know about Kia Trammell, who is a local musician who has a new single out right now called Double Rainbow and a new music video for that song. Kia, it's just so great to hear your voice again, and hopefully we'll hear more of it live and in the coming months.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Yes, the rap party for Outside the Loop, show number 761, where Colin and I do a little recap of the show, offer some takeaways, and my hat's off to Dr. Vargas and his students and anyone who's working on a project like this, because, boy, there is so much information to sift through and to analyze and to interpret. And when you're trying to keep other agencies honest when it comes to data, that's not an easy thing. And so I know he's trained in that, but it's still not an easy, it's not an easy thing. If you've ever taken a statistics class, oh my goodness, it's difficult. So I think it's important to keep, you know, like I said, city agencies honest. And this is incredibly important when the repercussions are, boy, we need more law enforcement, more police officers to prevent this from happening. And maybe that's the case in some areas, but overall, the data paint a different picture. So I thought that does what they're doing is pretty important, Colin.
You know, yeah, I thought the doctor, you know, extended some empathy, was like trying to, I liked the giving the benefit of the doubt in this case to journalists. But, you know, there's something to be said about having a analytical, data-driven, sociological lens and not sensationalizing news. That's something that happens for sure. It's absolutely something that happens. And journalists who do that should not be journalists. But anybody, whether it's public, private, whatever organization, you know, taking data to only show half of a picture to drive some sort of divisive narrative or divisiveness across the general public in a community is just insidious. And I'm not saying that was the entire picture here, but it's something we really got to look out for as a community and as a society.
Yeah. And like he said, like Dr. Vargas said, journalists sometimes aren't trained in that. And that can be a very difficult thing if this is the story that you're doing and you aren't trained in interpreting this data. That's difficult, which is why people like Dr. Vargas exist. And I think it's important to take a look at this story. And by the way, the full story was in the Chicago Reader. There was an extensive, a very extensive piece that was written recently about this issue. Dr. Vargas is quoted in it. And we'll link up to that, of course, on our social media channels. And that report from the Illinois Economic Policy Institute about working mothers, I mean, we knew that there was a gender gap before the pandemic, like we were talking about, but the pandemic really impacted that. And I think more data, I mean, I guess more data is coming in, but in terms anecdotally, in terms of the stories that we're hearing, right? And even the survey that the IE PI did with U of I tells a story that this pandemic was really difficult for working mothers in Illinois.
I really liked so if there's a theme, I guess, I don't know, we always try to talk about themes on this show, right? Resilience, I think, is a really good theme across the board here. And it was brought up specifically in this particular segment. And I think that's absolutely right. I think we need to do better things. And whether you're like big government, small government, whatever, I just think as in general, if we look out for each other and we look out for the benefit of ourselves as Americans, Chicagoans, whatever, citizens of the world, like we need to be more resilient. We need to think about resiliency in smarter ways. And this is one of them. And whether the pandemic ends and people can go back to work and we see an uptick in women returning to the workplace, you know, we've lost some progress. All right. The data was cited, but I'm also really curious to see what percentage of men like don't go back into their particular working environment because they're staying home and being, because it takes a lot to raise kids. You know this, Mike.
Yeah.
But like extending sick time to cover kids in more ways than just my kid is sick and can't go to school. Options for working to cover gaps in childcare. Like all these things, I really think can help us in the future. And we've just seen how grossly insufficient we all were this last year with regards to this, and women especially. And it sucks. Like, you know, hats off to all women and all mothers out there who have just been leveled from a like exhaustion, capacity, everything standpoint because of this pandemic. It's really crappy.
Yeah, it's a bad hand that we've been dealt here, and especially like that study talks about for women. But I hope that something good comes out of this and that we actually have the will to, politically speaking, that is, to put some programs in place and some money behind some action that will make things right or maybe move things in the right direction. And I'll tell you, Colin, every time I think of a double rainbow, I think of you.
Me and Andy. You forgot Andy.
Oh, yeah. The double rainbow. You and Andy.
Right. Exactly.
Perfect. Kia rules. She's great.
Please check out Kia. Really, really talented artist. She's Chicago. It's like everything you want, listener, right? It's like great music. It's from your backyard. It's everything. So go check out that video. Go check out Kia if you can. Live the next time she's performing. It's a great time out.
And you can hear some more live music from Kia if you go to Outside the Loop, show number 573 from October of 2017. It's at OutsideTheLoopRadio.com. Full-length interview again. She's live in studio. She's playing live with some musicians, and her voice is so cool, so powerful, and just soulful. She's awesome. She's great.
Yeah, those were the days when her keyboardist, I'll never forget, her keyboardist literally just double parked on Michigan Avenue and like played the entire set with the car, still running, still with the lights on Michigan Avenue, and, you know, just got it done. Like, they were running in, he needed to come in, he did, and we had the old studio, you could see the street from there, like, just watch that thing like a hawk, in case somebody was coming, I'd like run out and get it, but I never had to. It like totally pulled it off. And it was a great time.
I forgot her keyboardist who was like, he was like half asleep. I mean, he was so tired. And I remember in the interview, if you go back and you listen to it, he's like, man, I'm just a friend of hers. Like, she needed a keyboardist. So I came in and he was so good. And he's like, he just double parked at Michigan Avenue. He's like, am I cool there? We're like, ah, it's 6 a.m. on Michigan Avenue. Yeah, let's roll the dice here because we're about to go on the air. So those were the days. Oh boy, Outside the Loop show 573. You can check that out again, OutsideTheLoopRadio.com. That's it. That's all we got, Colin. I'm spent. I'm going to go sleep for like 6 days, except I can't because I've got to go back to school. When school's over, I'll sleep for 6 days and then we'll talk.
Go get that double rainbow.
And that's the wrap party for Outside the Loop show number 761. Wrap party. And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 761 is all wrapped up just for you. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Colin for producing. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for being our engineer. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop on 720 WGN.
We'll be right back.